Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to The Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church. And for the next half hour or so, your host, as we do indeed unpack three big questions that were raised from Sunday's sermon. We continued our Eastertide sermon series, the series that is following the lectionary readings, those four readings that are assigned to each of the Sundays, and in particular, the period between Easter Sunday and Pentecost. And Roxanne Lawler, our associate pastor, spoke on the lectionary reading from the Epistle of Peter, where Peter talks about the living stones and the chosen people, identifying his readers, who were primarily Gentile, and going through a pretty hard time, that they had indeed been chosen by God, that they were set aside for a purpose. And the emphasis in terms of the resurrected life, which is our theme for this series, is on the doing of all of this together. You can't be a temple on your own. You need other living stones around you. You can't really just follow after Jesus on your own. And so being engaged with one another is a fairly important part of our overall discipleship. And the fact that Jesus has been raised from the dead, the living stone, and upon whom we are being built, becomes a pretty important foundation for our ongoing discipleship and experience of the resurrected life. The three questions that came out of that, or that I'm going to address today, are these. If Peter's readers were Gentiles, would they have recognized and understood the Old Testament references? So if you had your Bible or had a look at the text itself, you'd notice that there are at least, well, there are three quotations from the Old Testament, you know, set aside and indented. And then, you know, Rox mentioned at least one other allusion to Exodus 19, where a lot of the language is very, very similar. There are other allusions in that passage as well. There's a significant allusion to Hosea chapter 2. And while the quotes, I suppose, might have been easy to identify, the others would not. So it's a good question. Would the Gentiles who had come to faith quite late in the piece, would they be aware of them? So that's the first question. Second is this. Rox mentioned emperor worship. Was this just propaganda or more? So again, in Rox's introduction, when she was just giving us just a brief context to the people that Peter was writing to, noted that they're in the area of Asia Minor, the Roman province of Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey, and did mention, just somewhat in passing, emperor worship and the pressure that put on them. So I'll unpack that a little bit, because it's actually a fairly key part of the context to the New Testament, some of the context that we tend not to be aware of, because as far as the writers were concerned, they didn't need to draw attention to it because everybody knew about it. And thirdly, Peter says that those who rejected Jesus were destined to do so. Is this referring to predestination? So we'll unpack that a little bit as well. So it's a great text, a great passage, a good reminder for us about our corporate life together and what that looks like. So let's get stuck into these questions. So if Peter's readers were Gentiles, would they have recognized and understood the Old Testament references? So as I said, you know, in our Bibles, most of our English translations at any rate, we have visual clues that there's a quotation. So first of all, you know, it's often indented so that we know that it's a section from another text. We have footnotes that tell us where the text is from and those sorts of things. The original hearers of Peter's letter would most likely have heard it read. When we were going through the first part of Romans, which was the last part of Romans because we're preaching Romans backwards, long story, come back in a few weeks when we pick it up again. I mentioned that Phoebe, who is the first person Paul refers to in Romans 16, the final chapter of the letter, that Phoebe may very well have been the person who read the letter to the congregation, that she kind of came as Paul's emissary, and that her job was not just to read the letter, but it was to read and to explain the letter. So I don't know exactly what that would have looked like, but there may have been questions that arose, or she may have been instructed even by Paul to, you know, make sure that this part is really clear. And there may have been, I suspect there would have been, some sort of oral indicator that this is a quotation, right? That I'm quoting from the Old Testament, or I'm referring to something in the Old Testament. Now, there are, you know, as I said in the text itself, some indicators, right? So in chapter 2, verse 6, Peter actually says, "For in Scripture it says." So, okay, now we know that there's going to be a quotation. But then he interrupts the quotation with a little bit of an editorial. "Now to you who believe, this stone is precious, but to those who do not believe," and then he quotes again without saying that he's quoting, and then says, and makes another quote. So I suspect that the reader, whoever was reading this on behalf of Peter, would have mentioned to the congregation that this was an Old Testament text. I can't be certain of that, obviously, and therefore, you know, it's hard to know for sure. I believe, though, that Gentile believers, probably like believers today, really, often, Christians spend a lot of time in the New Testament and not a heap of time in the Old Testament, for a bunch of reasons. You know, we're Christians, we're followers of Jesus, and so the stories of Jesus and the reflections on Jesus's life are, well, that's the New Testament. So we spend a lot of time there. And the Old Testament, for lots of reasons, it can be a little bit tricky to understand and get our heads around. And yet, there would still be, I don't know, a top 40 list of passages and stories in the Old Testament that you would expect someone who's been around the church for a while would probably have heard and bumped into. And I think while that list might change a little bit over time, I suspect that in the early church there was also a bit of a top 40. So, you know, for instance, you know, this the quotation of the Psalms. He quotes Psalm 118, "The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." That is part of Jesus's teaching, if I recall correctly. And it was one of those psalms that was connected quite strongly to the person of Jesus. And so you can imagine that your general basic instruction around Christianity would have reflected on that psalm a little bit. Isaiah 28:16, which is, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone. The ones who trust in him will never be put to shame, connects to Jesus. So I anticipate that this wasn't the first time that Peter had used this language. The reference to Isaiah 8 about the stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall, all three of these passages have to do with stones, right, in buildings and the reactions to them and all those sorts of things. So I can imagine that these would have been relatively familiar passages, so that even if the speaker didn't kind of explain it, that you could have leaned over to your Jewish neighbor, for instance, because the churches were primarily Gentile but still had Jewish believers, and asked them, "Can you tell me a little bit more about that text?" And they would have been able to tell them a little bit more about it because they would have been well known. The allusions to the Old Testament, I think, are harder to quantify. So Rox pointed out that there's a bunch of language around in verse 9 about being a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that comes right out of Exodus 19:4-6. It's right before God introduces the law to the people and invites them into a relationship with him. And the parallels, if you were to read Exodus 19:4-6, and then immediately afterwards read that section in Peter, like, the parallels are really, really clear. And they speak to purpose, and they speak to the plans of God, and they speak to the identity of the people of Israel and all those sorts of things. I don't know how familiar that would have been, but maybe it also existed as some sort of standard teaching. Then there's another reference to Hosea, where, you know, Hosea as prophets sometimes did in the Old Testament, has three children and gives them prophetic names, two of which are Not Loved and Not My People. Not great names for kids on the playground, you can imagine, but the names that God asked him to give the children as a sign to the people around him of their relationship with the Lord. And at the end of chapter 2 in Hosea, the Lord actually promises that there's going to be a restoration and that those that he called not loved will be loved and those that were not my people will become my people. And so there's this reference to that promise at the end of this section in 1 Peter 2. So there are some really clear places where those connections are made. Would the people have been aware of them? I'm going to say probably. That's the official answer, probably. On the basis that there would have been a fair amount of instruction from the Old Testament to connect to Jesus, both for Jewish believers, so that they understood that there was this continuity of a continuity of God's plan that had now taken a very different form. No temple to speak of because it's a living temple. The inclusion of the Gentiles, that was new. And yet at the same time, they were seeking to demonstrate that while it may have been a new chapter, it was part of the same book. That this has been part of God's plan from the beginning. So I imagine that the passages that Peter is using here would have been, broadly speaking, familiar to the people, that they would have been familiar enough with them and either had them explained by the speaker, the person who was reading the letter, or by those around them, because they represent some really significant places where there's a connection with the Gentiles in the Old Testament, and where there's this connection of identity and purpose throughout. So, yeah, I suspect that they probably did. I don't know if they were sitting by themselves in a room and read it aloud that they would have picked them up. But I think in the community of faith, which was kind of Rox's point, I think in the community of faith, there's the shared knowledge that we can help one another identify and think through the places where the Old Testament comes to play. That's the best scenario I can imagine at this point. So Rox, in her introduction, I suppose you'd say, to the letter, just drew our attention to the very first couple of verses in chapter 1, where Peter identifies the people he's writing to, and they were people in the Roman province of Asia Minor, or modern-day Turkey. And Rox just pointed out that, you know, they were primarily Gentiles, because that was a primarily Gentile area. There were Jewish believers and synagogues and whatnot in that region. Paul, in his travels, as recorded in the book of Acts, travels through that area, stops in various cities, goes to the synagogue. So there were Jews there, but they were primarily Gentile territories. And also that they were beginning to experience some hardship. Like, that's part of the reason why Peter is writing. They're finding it a little bit tough, actually, to follow Jesus, and they need to be encouraged. And so that's part of Peter's purpose in writing. And then she mentioned, somewhat in passing, the role of emperor worship. And so the question is, is this propaganda or is this more? And I think the simple answer would be that it's yes, it is propaganda and it is more. Imperial worship was a unifying principle around the Roman Empire. So wherever you went in the Roman Empire, the Romans essentially allowed the vast majority of local religious practices to continue. What they often insisted upon, not always, I mean, they didn't insist on this in Jewish territories because it would lead to rioting all the time, but in most territories, they insisted upon the inclusion of the emperor alongside the other local deities. In a polytheistic culture, you know, where you've got 15 gods, adding one more seems reasonable, off you go. And the imperial worship, the worship of the emperor and the families of the emperors, was a little bit of propaganda, but it was a lot more. So the idea was that the emperor was associated with the good life, right? The power of Rome was being cast not as oppressive, not as restrictive, not as a negative thing, but as just a really wonderful thing, like a really wonderful thing. I mean, how blessed are we to have Rome here, you know? And there was a bunch of, shall I say, evidence for that. You know, there was the Roman peace that had lasted for quite a long time, particularly in the heart of the empire. And when there's peace, there tends to be prosperity. And when there's safety on the highways that they have been building and there's safety on the waterways that they patrol, business flourishes, people do quite well for themselves, the arts flourish, like it's all the good stuff. And so there was this real sense that the imperial worship was connected to the good life. Where it was more is in that connection to the good life. When I've taught on this at, you know, at Moreland College or other places, one of the ways that I speak about imperial worship is to connect it to things like democracy and free market capitalism. Because by and large, in our world, they are unquestioned goods. Like, you know, we're currently, there's, you know, more and more tension in the Middle East, but what do those countries need? You know, what does Iran need? Well, they need the people to rise up and establish a democracy, because if they establish a democracy, then everything would be fine. There's this assumption that the democratic principles that's the secret to the good life, that free market capitalism is the source of the good life. Now, it's unquestioned, even though we know that there are other ways to govern and there are other forms of markets and all those sorts of things, but they have become so pervasive everywhere that by and large, we don't really question them. Imperial worship was a little bit that way. You worship the emperor because, well, it's pretty obvious that he is the source of all that is good. And in Asia Minor in particular, imperial worship had been enthusiastically accepted. So in Judea, it had been roundly rejected. But in Asia Minor, they loved the emperor. There were all sorts of temples to the emperor. And those were pretty significant because they had to be given Senate approval. You couldn't just build a temple to the emperor. You had to get approval, and they were really competitive. It's kind of like the Olympics or the World Cup. Lots of cities would bid for the right to build one of these imperial temples. So in Asia Minor, it was a really, really big deal. And because it was an unquestioned good, if people began to reject the unquestioned good, it brought a certain degree of trouble, kind of almost by definition, right? You think about, I don't know if you've seen any of the news stories about, you know, sovereign citizens who kind of want to live in the world, but do it on their own terms and just kind of ignore everything except the stuff that they want. To some degree, it's a little bit like that. People just look at them a little bit, oh, you're a little bit weird and you're a little bit dangerous. In the first century, piety, or the proper religious observances, which would have included observances to the emperor and his family, were a really important public part of your life. For Christians to stop saying that the emperor was Lord and to say that Jesus is Lord and to no longer participate in all of the festivals and the prayers and the songs and all the stuff that happened, you know, at the openings of meetings and the close of meetings and festival days and whatnot, would have led people to suspect that they were impious people. And that would have had all sorts of implications. Most likely, it would have had, gossip about them, slander about them. That might have led to, you know, financial difficulties. If I am going to be, you know, put into tender renovation, Well, I'm not going to ask the impious Christian fellow. I don't want him associated with my business or my home. I don't want people in the community saying, oh, you hired him. So I don't include him in that anymore. And so Christians found themselves more and more on the outer. At this early stage in Christianity, there were instances of physical violence and imprisonment and whatnot, but it tended to be that lower level economic hardship of just being marginalized and becoming a little bit of a minority, really, because they were a minority. And so I think imperial worship is central to that. It plays a fairly significant role in a lot of the New Testament, particularly, say, the book of Revelation. But again, because it was everywhere, the epistles don't particularly talk about it much, because I think they assumed that everyone knew what they were talking about, that everyone knew. So when Paul says, you know, anyone who confesses that Jesus is Lord, he doesn't have to stop and say, now, for those of you who don't understand, you know, imperial worship says that Caesar is Lord, and so this is a really subversive statement. He just says it knowing that everyone will get it. We tend to miss it because it's not our same reality. So imperial worship was propaganda. You know, basically, the imperial family is amazing. We should respect them. We should honor them. We should go along with all that they do. But it was more because it was so clearly associated with the good life in kind of every possible way, that it became this unquestioned good in society. So I hope that helps. It does, I think, then heighten for us the kind of hardship that Peter's readers were experiencing, and helps us make some sense then of what he's doing when he talks about their identity and their purpose, which I think leads into our final question. So Peter says that those who rejected Jesus were destined to do so. Is this referring to predestination? And again, I'll give you a simple answer, and that is no. But no with a but. Peter is writing to a group of people who are experiencing hardship. And when we experience hardship, particularly because we're part of a particular group, right? There's a number of temptations, right? And for many of us, particularly if we have, you know, an Anglo-Saxon background, we tend not to experience this very much in the majority white world, because we aren't the minority where we live and work very often. Sometimes we are. And even if we are, because the majority culture is our culture, we don't, I think, feel as threatened as we might. But you can imagine immigrant families from a country, you know, in Africa or in Asia or in South America, coming to Australia, and if they experience discrimination and racism and prejudice, there are a couple of responses, aren't there? The one, I suppose, is to get kind of militant about it and really try to resist it, but that's super hard. The more common, of course, is to just try to fit in, right? You get your job, you keep your head down, you act more Anglo-Saxon, right? You learn the language, right? You try to fit in as best as you can. And there's an element, of course, where, you know, you land in a new country, you do want to fit in. You know, speaking the language is not compromise. It's actually, you know, really helpful to kind of navigate the place. But you know what I'm getting at, right? There's a temptation to diminish the cultural differences that end up causing you trouble, right? When people start making fun of you or ridiculing you or discriminating against you. So for Peter's readers, that's the kind of pressure that they were under, that they were under pressure to kind of stop acting like a Christian and act like a normal citizen of Asia Minor. Like, just do the stuff. And you can imagine that there would have been all sorts of ways that they could have suppressed their Christian identity in public, right? Ways that they could have gone through the motions of fitting in while still maintaining their Christian faith. And Peter, consistent with the rest of the New Testament, encourages them not to compromise. Like, don't compromise on your faith. It's too important. And so for people who are experiencing that kind of pressure, one of the things that they need to be reminded about and empowered about is who they are and the value and the benefit and the good of their cultural background, their ethnic and racial heritage, right? Their religious preferences, all those sorts of things. And to strengthen them, to kind of go, listen, it's good. You're fine, right? This is a good thing. Don't compromise. It's too valuable to lose. And to some degree, that's what Peter is doing throughout this letter, but particularly in this section. He's saying to these primarily Gentile believers, you are not just some Gentile believers in Jesus who are going through a hard time. He said, you are part of God's plan. You have come to Jesus, the living stone. You're being built into a living temple. You're the ones through whom people will engage with God and through whom the blessing of God will come. You're the ones who are chosen and the special possession and the royal nation and the royal priesthood and the holy nation. You are the continuation of the promises of God to Israel. You are the ones through whom God is going to restore and renew all things. It's just too important to set aside. And one of the other things then that Peter does is he increases their sense of being special. That's probably that makes it sound a little bit too, it doesn't sound quite what I'm after. But he also tells them that those who have rejected Jesus have then rejected them because, well, they were not the chosen ones. So I don't think, here's why I say then that this is not about predestination. I don't believe that Peter here necessarily has salvation front and center in his mind. Now, obviously, if you reject Jesus in the New Testament context, salvation's a little bit hard to find. But I don't think that his primary focus is on salvation per se, as much as it is on reminding the Gentile believers who they are. And that they are those who have come to Jesus in faith. And that puts them in, well, very significant company. It ties them into the story of Israel, you know, in the book of Hebrews. It connects them to the great men and women of faith. There is the emphasis on, you know, you are those who have seen clearly, you have responded in faith, and those around you who have rejected Jesus haven't rejected Jesus because they're right. They haven't rejected Jesus because they're smarter than you are or more pious than you. They have rejected Jesus because, well, that's how this was always going to go. That Jesus would be this divisive figure and not everyone would respond. But to those who did, keep your purpose in mind, right? That you are there to be the living temple so that should these people one day turn to the Lord, that they can turn to you to be introduced to him, right? And so I think that Peter's primary focus is not on the salvation issue of individuals, but on the identity of the people that he's writing to encourage them to continue to be firm in the faith and to be faithful to Jesus and not to compromise and to go through the suffering and the hardship that they have to go through. I mean, throughout the letter, he refers to the example of Jesus, right? And how nice is that? When you go through suffering for the faith, you are doing what Jesus did, right? You're experiencing the same thing he did, and you're experiencing the same thing he did in a really significant way, right? Jesus ate fish, but we don't say, hey, when I eat fish, I'm doing just like Jesus, because it's not the same. But when we're suffering for our faith, I mean, Jesus suffered and died for the plans and purposes of God. Like, it's the very heart of what we believe about Jesus, about our Christian life. When we suffer with him, Peter says, like, man, we're right there. So don't give up that privileged position, even though it's difficult, right? Jesus suffered because it was worth it. We need to suffer because it's worth it, right? All those sorts of things. So again, I don't think the predestination piece is about other people being saved or not being saved. But there is a sense that Peter wants to reinforce for his hearers that, you know, you have responded in faith, and there are those who are going to reject the things of God. And you can't allow those who reject the things of God to determine how you're going to live. I mean, they rejected God. And that's not great. So don't allow them to pressure you into living like them. In fact, it should be the other way around. You need to be the chosen people and the holy nation, the royal priesthood, and all those things. So I hope that makes some sense of that passage, of that text, and I hope that those three questions help you think this through a little bit more deeply. Thanks to those who entered the questions. This week we continue the Eastertide series. I'll be preaching. I think I'm going to be looking at Psalm 66, the Old Testament passage that is the lectionary reading this year as we continue to this Sunday, as we continue to reflect on the resurrection life in this period between Easter Sunday and Pentecost. Hope you can join me then. And until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.